Hello, thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for our show today. My very special guest, returning guest, is Dina Miriam, and we'll be talking about her newest book, The Untold Story of Sita, An Empowering Tale for Our Time. In her latest book, Dina takes a new look at the classic Ramayana by tearing away the patriarchal lens through which the story is traditionally viewed. In the traditional account, Sita is a secondary figure, and her true nature is hard to access. In this reading of the story, told by the people of Sita's household, the role of the sacred feminine is predominant. Dina Miriam is founder of the interfaith organization, the Global Peace Initiative of Women. For more information, you can visit the website, which is gpiw.org. Again, that's gpiw.org. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dina to the show. Good day, Dina.
Good day. Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I can't believe it's just been over a year that we spoke of when we talked about your memoir, My Journey Through Time.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Boy.
But I was busy at work on the second book, which I see as a kind of a sequel going back further in time.
Oh, great. Well, I'm happy to see that, and again, happy to have you with me today. So I guess the first thing we should maybe talk about is the traditional Ramayana. Can you tell us a little bit, what that story is about?
Well, the story is really the foundation of Indian civilization. It's a story that goes back about 7,000 years, and it really is at the founding of what was to become the Indian civilization. And it's the story of there is historical evidence to the story. So there was a prince named Ram, and there was a princess Sita, and they're both considered to be very, very saintly figures, because this was considered to be a higher age, and we could talk about later what that means, a higher age. They marry, and as soon as Sita gets to Ayodhya, which is his kingdom, there is one of the stepmothers creates a situation where they're forced into banishment because she wanted her son to become the king. He's the eldest and is destined to be the king, but she forces a situation where he's exiled. And they travel through the forests, down through the south, and live in the jungle, and visit many of the hermitages and the sages. This is like the early educational institutions of India. And then they're banished for 14 years. At the end of the time period, the last year, she's kidnapped by one of the most ruthless demonic figures, a Hitler-type figure. And Ram wages a war to rescue her, and she's rescued, and then they return to Ayodhya. And then a later edition has it that because she lived away from him in another man's kingdom for a year, he's got to send her to the forest where she raises their two kids. This was a later addition. So I always questioned that, thinking, why would he supposed to be the essence of Dharma, of right action? Why would he do this to his beloved wife? I mean, the whole Ramayana is filled with love story, their great love that they had. She's definitely a secondary figure. He's the hero. She like a dutiful wife. They say it's because she's a dutiful wife. She follows him into the jungle for 14 years. But in actuality, she is a sage, a great saintly figure herself. And you have to read between the lines to see that. Many people do read between the lines, but it's not apparent. She's, you know, then kidnapped and he has to rescue her. So there's a very strong patriarchal overlay. And so I've always loved the story. I read it when I was in my early 20s. But it was when I actually took a pilgrimage to the place where they lived that I began to have these insights. And I think of them as memories of having lived at that time, but you can also call it as if I was channeling some of the people who were living at that time, and began to see it in a very different light. I began to see Sita as the heroine, along with Ram being the hero, and that they equally, because what he achieved was that he freed the whole southern part of India. India at this time, that civilization was just in the north. And in their journey through the south, they freed India from many of the cannibal tribes in terms of converting them and showing them how to use agriculture. And so there was a whole transformation that took place in that space, in that regional space, through their journey. And it really was the beginning of the modern region of India as a unified, as one unit.
Wow, I mean, it is quite a story. And when you mentioned patriarchal, and you know, that as far as a kind of society, you know, that. So do you feel that? Well, one of the things is that you mentioned the higher age. So the period in which Sita and Ram, during that particular period, what do you mean by higher age?
Well, in the Eastern understanding of time, it's not only linear. In the Western concept, we see time as linear, so that we move from primitive time, cave dwellers, hunter gatherers, to early agriculture, to small town. So we see that as an evolution toward civilization, you know, evolution, advancement of civilization. In the Indian framework, in the Hindu-Buddhist framework, time is cyclical. As well as following that linear development, there's a cycle to it. And that has to do with the spiritual development of man. So that there was a time when there was heightened spiritual perceptions, when the rishis lived and they had greater understanding of the underlying framework of the universe, of the higher principles of the universe. So they knew about the gravitational forces, they understood magnetism, electricity, all those things. And that knowledge was lost as people became more and more focused on outer development. And so it looks at the inner consciousness of humanity, as opposed to what did the outer conditions look like? Were there big cities? That's an outer condition. And so this took place during a period in the Indian context. There are four different yugas: the higher one, Satya Yuga, the Yuga of Truth, and then the next one is the third yuga, the Treta Yuga, and then Dwapara, and then the Kali, which is the darkest age, where mankind only sees the material world and really can't see beyond material creation. So it's materialism, you know, a complete focus on the external world, on the externals. And so, which is the time that we're supposedly just coming out of now. So this was an age. So what does that mean? This was an age before there was strong individuation, where there was much greater harmony with the natural world. You could converse with the animals through the exchange of images, which is what Sita did. She was able to know many things through connecting with the animal world. She knew that there was just an enormous amount of herbal medicines and plant life, so much of which has disappeared now, where you could really exist, you know, and all kinds of ailments could be healed just from the forests. And so there was much greater unity with the natural world. And gradually this sense of separateness developed, and more sense of humanity being above and superior and the need to dominate. And so I see the patriarchal emergence of the patriarchal mentality accompanied the emergence of the domination dominating nature. You know, you could control the forest. The animals were a resource to be used as you will. The plant life was all for man's pleasure instead of us being an integral part of the whole, and it all worked in harmony. So they lived at a critical time when so much knowledge was being lost, and the unity with the natural world was being lost, and knowledge of the spiritual realms. And that's why these hermitages, which were being established by the sages of that time in the forest, was to preserve the knowledge. These were the first educational institutions, and that's where everything was codified. The Vedas were written down, put down. And the part of Ram's and Sita's journey was to help strengthen these educational institutions and protect them from the cannibal tribes that still were roaming the jungles.
Well, now, you talked about the yugas, the different periods, and indicated that we were right now emerging from that dark one, that materialistic one.
Yeah.
Was that correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so what's next? I mean, you know, I'm just curious because I had never really heard, you know, about the yuga theory, you know, perspective. So there were four different ones that you mentioned. So is this like a cyclical thing where, like, the seasons change?
It's a cyclical thing, but it still has a movement toward greater and greater complexity. So one yuga is not like the other, and the cyclical part of it is that, so we're moving out of the purely materialistic age where we're beginning to understand, even the science is beginning to understand the finer elements of electricity, and physics is beginning to understand certain things that are spiritual principles. And I mean, still so much that we don't understand. We don't really understand what electricity is. We can see how it works, but we don't really know what it is. Same thing with magnetism. We don't know what that is. We don't know, you know, what's this magnetism at the center of each galaxy that holds it together, these dark holes. We have no idea. We only observe now, but we've advanced in that we can observe these things, and we know that there are many, many. There's a scientist, a physicist at Columbia University, who says that Einstein's theories only work in a universe of, I see, the 7 or 9 dimensions. So physics is discovering the existence of other dimensions. And I think that, you know, knowledge is developing rapidly. So we are gonna move into a world where we accept the fact that there are other realities that we can't perceive with the senses.
Yeah, you know, the idea of moving toward that, I mean, excuse me, I think it's going to take, it may happen sooner than I think, but there's a lot of people have some major shifting going on.
All traditions, religious traditions, have, we call it a story, but I call it a memory of a higher age, the Garden of Eden. You know, what was that? It's not just this symbolic story. You know, there's a collective memory of a time when we lived in harmony with the natural world as part of it, and there was balance, and that was all disrupted as material desires came in, the consciousness shifted, and so we fell out of that state of being in unity with the natural world, and I think that also in the ancient stories and all traditions there are that the people spoke to the angels appeared to them. So in the Eastern concept, that was, we were able, in the higher ages, we were able to perceive these higher beings, you know, the gods, or, you know, every tradition talks about the gods interacted with man. So the spiritual sight was open, and we could interact with them, and then that's very rare now. I mean, there are some people who may be able to do it, but it's not a common occurrence.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, when you think about just scientifically that, you know, we use such a small part of our brain and there's such a huge part of our DNA that we don't know what it's for, I mean, I can understand why, where, I mean, I could visualize where a lot of area in both of those kind of conditions are some of that the telepathy, that connection, you know, or types of gifts that, you know, got turned off through the generations.
Right, right. Those gifts, somehow, as we developed more and more in the material world, to the point of now, you know, near destruction. We've forgotten the other capabilities, and I think now we're at a point, at an evolutionary moment, where we have to reflect on what is our goal, what is our, you know, what are we here for, and what really brings us happiness.
Yeah, I agree. So now I want to talk a little bit about that the connection to the to the natural world, and one that was, you know, during that time, you know, much stronger, and that's been lost, you know, in recent times. What is your view of that connection to nature? I mean, as we're coming out of this dark yuga, how do you see nature playing a role in what's next? Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the main messages of the book is showing how much how distance we've become. Where I read a statistic now of the percentage of Americans that live in cities, and another 20 years it's going to be like 80%, where people don't even touch the earth. People don't experience animal life, and so many of the animals are going extinct. They're talking about the insects being gone, and we've lost understanding of how every animal, every plant has a role to play in the whole web of things. It's like you can't get rid of the insects and not have the whole. It's like taking a brick out of a building. You know, the whole building is weakened, and so we have become so distracted. When you think of what we've done to the earth, putting our garbage into the ocean and harming ocean life, I mean, how could we have been doing this? How could we have been so oblivious to the fact that this was harming the whole chain of life? You know, how could we be, you know, doing so much extractive work, you know, bringing out uranium and all kinds of things, and using toxins to extract that and not think it's going to affect the water? I mean, like, how stupid are we that we didn't see that this was leading to a dire condition? And this is the knowledge that we've lost, that we've just so cut ourselves off from understanding how interconnected everything is and how interdependent everything is. And that we're harming ourselves by harming the other parts of life. And this was a time, and it shows, you know, throughout the Sita book, what it meant to live in harmony with the natural world, how connected she was to the animals. I mean, there's a story in there about later on when Sita, through the end of her life, goes back to live in the forest, and a hunter had killed one of her cubs. And then in retribution, she went and killed a child from a forest village. And, you know, and so then the villagers want to go and hunt her, and then it's a cycle, goes on and on. So she steps in and stops this and sends the sends the leopard deeper into the forest. She knows now that this is the beginning of a disconnect between the human community and the animal community, and tells the villagers, enough, enough, you know, you take just what you need, but don't take anything more from the forest. And so I think that you know, the purpose, you know, my hope is that it helps us reflect more on where we've come, the point we've come to, and what we need to regain, and then how do we regain it?
Yeah, when I look at the attention that nature is getting, and quite honestly, it's because she's rearing her anger, you know, here and there that gets people's attention. But I mean, it seems that, you know, that those kinds of occurrences are helping in raising awareness and you know, trying to at least communicate that connectedness, you know, that was lost.
Yeah, I mean, I work a lot with young ecologists, and I hear it mostly among the young people who just feel, oh my God, how did we get here? How did we get to this situation where we've harmed so much life? And one of the young men I work with, he actually lives in Dominican Republic, and he's very connected to the whales and the dolphins, and he's followed their behavior, he's studied their behavior, and he talks about their consciousness and has recorded some of their songs, which are hauntingly beautiful. And their songs can travel, they can communicate 3,000 miles to another whale 3,000 miles away. So, you know, there's intelligence all around us. And now there's research about how trees in a forest communicate their needs through the root system. If one is weak, others will send nourishment through the roots. So there's a lot of intelligence in nature. And nature knows to balance itself. I remember we did a program in Africa at one point, and I learned there that when the buffalo herds get too big, there are more lions are born, and they eat more buffalo. And then when the buffalo herds get too weak, the lions die off, and the buffaloes go stronger again, and it starts again and again. This cycle of keeping it in balance. Can't be too many buffaloes, can't be too many lions. And so there's an intelligence in nature, and we have to attune ourselves again. And what that may mean is we may have to change our whole desire system, you know, and just look at the things that we are doing to support a certain kind of society and level of consumption.
Yeah, you know, nature does have that ability to equalize things if given a chance, you know, So, and I do believe that, you know, we are, that the awareness is getting there, but I still think, you know, I guess some of that, that materialism yoga is just, it's hanging on. I mean, you know, you can kind of see it in the decisions that are being made, whether it be, you know, if it helps the, you know, ecology or not, you know, or is it, you know, bottom line dollars, you know? So, I mean, I still think, you know.
Everything, you know, our whole way of thinking is about growth. Grow, you know, we have to grow our economy. And, you know, there have been I've heard figures that we would need, if everybody were to live like we live in America, we would need three Earths. So, you know, we have to recognize there has to be limits to growth. And so how else can we begin to think about it? It's beginning to think about, we've focused so much on outer development and not enough on inner development.
Right.
You know, and the whole education is about, you know, what is success? Success is all these outer things, and not enough on, you know, character development, or, you know, what kind of people are we? And so I think the focus has to shift more toward an inner development, and looking at a different quality of life, you know, It's interesting because here we are, the wealthiest country, the nation in the world, and we have so many depressed people and so many people addicted to opioids, addicted to some kind of drug. So how do you, so clearly this is not bringing us happiness.
Right. Exactly, yes. Well, Dina, we're about halfway through the show, so I want to take just a quick break, and I do want to invite listeners, if they would like to call in and ask any questions, they can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to post them there. And then when we come back from the break, Dina, I wanted to talk about the fact that you wrote this book in the first person. So I'd like to know all about that, why you did that, and all the stuff behind it, okay?
Okay.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, BiteRadio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,400 shows we have had over the past 9 years. Also on the site is a link to the products and services we provide: books, photography, a wellness store, and self-publishing assistance. Our show is a free podcast on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn. And you can subscribe for free on any of those platforms by using the links on our website homepage. We are on many social media platforms: Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms at the top of our homepage. Our website, BiteRadio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us again. Today, my very special guest is Dina Miriam, and we are talking about her new book, The Untold Story of Sita, An Empowering Tale for Our Time. And again, you can find out more about Dina, as she is the founder of an interfaith organization, the Global Peace Initiative of Women. And again, you can find out more by visiting their website, which is gpiw.org. gpiw.org. Okay, with that, we're back. Dina?
Good.
Okay, great. So, first person, tell me, why you chose that approach. Tell me all about that.
Okay. Well, the book I wrote, My Journey Through Time, was a memoir of my recollections that emerged at different points in my life of previous births. And they came through so clearly, often in meditation or during periods of reflection, stimulated often when I'd meet somebody or go to a certain place. But it went back several hundred years. And I was amazed each time, actually, that, there was more. I mean, of course, those of us who have a strong experience of rebirth, believe that we've go back way back in time, in time. That it's not just you've had four or five. That there have been hundreds of lives, if not more. And so I've wondered I've remembered the most recent ones, and so I had no expectation of anything more. And then I've said to myself, I know I have much older lives in India. I know that I have such a deep connection to India and a deep connection to this story of the Ramayana that I know that somehow that was real to me. And then when I took a trip and I went on several pilgrimages to India about 3 years ago, as soon as I got to this place, Ayodhya, which is a small temple town in the north of India, which was where Ram lived, and then Sita, after she married, went there. As soon as I went there, I entered another realm, and I began seeing things. And, you know, it seemed, part of me said, well, this is crazy, you know. You're going back how many thousands of years? But I couldn't stop these stories from coming through. They came through as memories. So I wrote it in the first person as one of the servants in the household, which is how I identified. I really saw myself as one of the servants in the household. And there's a whole story around that servant of her family having been the subject of a curse and have been taken in by Sita's family for many generations. And then how her father took care of me, really. And then went with her, as did several other servants, when she married. And then died before she was able to return. And so I at some point said to myself, I don't know if these are my memories or whether I'm channeling somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether there's this servant who wants to get this story out. and then
right.
I said to myself, you know, it really doesn't matter, because I was so more than inspired. The writing of this book had a great effect on me, because for a long time I've accepted this cyclical vision of history as having true. It made sense to me, you know. I mean, it just made a lot of sense to me. But I wanted to peer into what it was like in a higher age. What was life like, you know? There's not a lot of information about that. You know, we just get these, you know, very kind of general stories, the Garden of Eden, or, you know, but I wanted to experience it. And so maybe it was that desire that led me into this either channeling or awakened memory stage, where I was able to peer. And I think that's one of the values of the book, is that I was able to capture something of what was taking place as humanity was standing at a threshold and losing a certain amount of inner spiritual perception, but gaining something in terms of material expansion. Because what Sita talks about is, you know, their empire was expanding, trade was developing, agriculture was expanding, new crops. I mean, this was kind of like at the beginning of the agricultural revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the outer plane, things were looking up, you know,
yeah,
more wealth, more migration, so more interaction between different communities, which means sharing of things. Arts were developing, so it was a critical stage in human evolution around 5000 BC, and I'm also a student of history, so. After I wrote the book, I began looking into a little bit about their history. There's very little that we know about that time, except through these stories. I mean, archaeology hasn't discovered a lot. There are things that have been found out to verify the existence of Ram and Sita, archaeological evidence, but we still know very little about what life was like, except through stories. What we might call myths, but myths are just collective memories. That's how I see it. And so I thought it was relevant because we're also standing at a transition point. I mean, here we are on the verge of moving into a civilization where artificial intelligence is woven into every aspect of our life, where we can now manipulate genes and determine, you know, the kind of children we're going to give birth to. This is a whole new chapter.
Oh, it is.
It's a whole new chapter. We don't know what it's going to be in 100 years, you know. And so we're standing also at a point where we have to stop and reflect on whether this is taking us toward a place of greater happiness and fulfillment, or whether we're going to be all be on opiates in a short period of time.
Yeah. I know. You know, it's, I just find it I mean, it's amazing the disconnect, you know, between this, you know, outward wealth and the inner loneliness that a lot of people feel, you know. And I can see where the outward develops, you know, the inward kind of takes a back seat. But it's, to me, it's you know, I'm the kind of, it's like, why can't we have both?
I think we can have both. I mean, that, okay. You know, we can have both, but we have to find a way to have comforts and beautiful things in a way that doesn't destroy life.
Yeah, smaller footprint and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so that's the challenge before us. But at first, I think the first step is acknowledging that we have to find a new way to have the beautiful things that we love. And I think there needs to be a more equitable agreement that we can't have just a few people taking it all.
Exactly. Okay. So now, in this story, you know, you talk about Sita kind of having a secondary role traditionally in the way that the story is told. But you are presenting this one in a more equal basis with Ram, Sita and Ram. So do you feel that Sita's station, so to speak, in life, in the way that she was portrayed traditionally, is something that we're coping with in today's world? You know, as far as women.
Yeah, I think that what I saw was that this story unfolded in a pre-patriarchal time. There was a some of the earliest images of deities or of the goddesses around the world. People are, you know, archaeologists have uncovered these ancient images of goddesses. And in Sita's time, one of her teachers actually was a woman sage, and she encountered many of the women sages in their journey through the forest, through the jungles. But the women who are known to have been, you know, of equal status spiritually as their rishi husbands, as the sages, are praised as being chaste and devoted wives of the sage. So and so was a chaste and devoted wife of sage so and so. When actually it's known that they had great powers themselves and achieved great things, and so it was a pre-patriarchal time, but as the story came down, things got put in place. So the question I raise is, many scholars have said that the last part of the book, where Ram banishes Sita for having lived in another man's house for 1 year, even though she was kidnapped, was added later. It was added later. It wasn't part of the original story. So my question is, why was it added? Why did society feel the need to add that part, that a woman has to be banished if she lives apart from her husband? And so that is what happened over time, is that in order to give a certain message to society and set up certain norms, the best a woman could achieve was to be a devoted wife. And that's what Sita models, you know, according to this later understanding. She models the perfect wife, and that's what a woman should aspire for. And if she, you know, for some reason is separated from her husband, she's got to be banished, because you've got to show all women that you know this is what happens. And I wanted to unwrap that patriarchal interpretation and really find out who these women sages were who Sita encountered, and who was Sita really? What was her power? What kind of, you know, she was a very strong-willed. I mean, for a woman at that time, a princess to leave the palace and to spend 14 years traveling through the jungle in cannibals' territory. You had to have a lot of courage.
I would think so. A lot of something, that's for sure.
So I think that we have to acknowledge that there was a time when there was a more equitable society, and the genders may have had different roles, but they were respected equally, and women had freedom of movement and freedom of spiritual study and, had a lot of freedoms, which they later lost, which maybe now we're regaining.
Yeah. I just wish we wouldn't lose knowledge.
Yeah, it would be nice, wouldn't it?
so much time and effort. I think in today's world, with the focus and awareness being on empowerment and the female archetype kind of coming into play more and more, do you think that we are moving toward back to an equitable scenario, or maybe is the pendulum going to swing to a matriarchal possibly?
Well, that's actually a question that I've been giving a lot of thought to, because I've noticed in my work and Ram is supposed to represent the ideal, the ideal male character, actually, and he expresses. I mean, his expression is one of compassion and love and support for Sita, and so I think we need to look as equally at awakening the higher male qualities. The patriarchal period that we came out of did justice to nobody. It didn't bring out, it was a control factor, just like we've been trying to control nature. I mean, the whole kind of momentum of the last few thousand years was one of domination. Domination of a gender, domination one religion over another. I mean, look, it's been a time of tremendous religious wars. Which religion is right? So it was time of domination. And that has to change now, because we'll destroy everything if we don't evolve beyond this gene of domination into one of cooperation, collaboration, and mutual respect. And so I think in that process, the higher male attributes will emerge, which are very much needed. I think there is a danger of going too far to one extreme and losing this balance, which is the key to happiness, is balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just agree, if we have that balanced perspective, I mean, it just to me, it's one of those where you can kind of see both sides of the coin. When it's balanced, you're kind of taking everything into account, versus, predominantly one way or the other. So,
and I think the universe is based on balance. It's like when one gets too strong, the other has to get stronger. And I think the male and the female complement each other. That's the way it is, naturally. And so not to compete with one another, but to complement one another. And so my hope, I mean, to me, the beauty of kind of experiencing the story of Ram and Sita as I tell it is seeing that complementariness between them and how they support one another in their work and the incredible love that develops between them, so that they make many sacrifices for each other. And, we can't forget that, one of the most precious things about human life are these relationships, love relationships. And so we want to treasure them and hold them sacred.
Yeah, exactly. And, to me, that's the relationships are what kind of survive, this life. That's what's kind of everlasting, so to speak. So what do you hope that the people, the readers, will take away from reading The Untold Story of Sita?
I think that there are a few key messages. One is the ecological message of how much is gained by reconnecting with the natural world. Not just one part of it, but all of it. The many stories about the rivers, as Sita encounters different rivers. It's coming into a consciousness of being mindful of the whole, of the forests, of the plants, of the soil, of the rivers. I mean, everything that supports life, which we have this incredible planet that we've neglected to the point of destroying, and in the process destroying ourselves. So it's a very strong ecological message that's woven throughout at the book. And I think it's, hoping people can pause and get a little glimpse of what it was like, especially young people who don't know what it was like to be able to drink from a river. I mean, I grew up at a time where the concept of bottled water did not exist. Young people mm-hmm. today don't know what it was like without bottled water. So it's just a very short time period. These young people have lost so much, and so it's that echo, and it's also a message about how to rebalance the genders, and how women can attain the same things that men are searching to attain, without threatening the contributions that each gender can make. So there's that, and then also looking at the time we are in our evolution, and seeing that there are stages where humanity has to kind of take a leap and evolve in a way that will support life. And so, we either evolve in a way that supports life, or we're going to destroy ourselves. I mean, we really are at a precipice, and so there's an urgency to reflecting on this of what kind of society we need to create, what kind of living conditions that can be fulfilling to us, but respect and honor all of the natural world. So it's these messages that kind of run through the book, and that I hope people think deeply about as they read it.
Well, those are all very important messages, really, in today's world. And quite honestly, any reader can, after reading the book, with that raised awareness, make better choices and decisions that would help the earth,
So there's another actually message. In Sita's kingdom, her father, King Janak, was known to have been a very wise king. They call him a Rishi king. Rishi is a sage. And in that kingdom, everybody was taken care of. Now, communities were much stronger. There weren't 8 million people.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been 500,000. There may have been 1 million. I don't know, in the whole kingdom. But there was a style of living where everybody had their needs taken care of, and it was the king's responsibility to make sure everybody had enough. Now, look at our king today.
mm-hmm.
I mean, look at. Do we say that is the role of the president, to make sure that everybody in the country is taken care of,
right?
that their health needs are met, that their food needs are met, that their shelter? That's the way it was. That was known to be the king's responsibility.
right.
And so there was this sense of, when we talk about a higher age, also we're talking about an inner integrity, one's desires didn't get away, and so you thought only about. Now, over time, the kings wanted more power. They wanted more land. They wanted more resources. There was expansion. Trade brought more wealth. That was a decline. We see that as an advance. Look how civilization developed, these great kingdoms of wealth. But the inner integrity was lost in the sense of this deep responsibility of the king to look, to know each of his subjects and to make sure their needs were all met. And so there was this decline of inner character while there was this focus on selfish needs, selfish, you know, desires.
Yeah, and look where we are now.
And look where we are now. So I say to myself, how do we get back? Well, it's not a short road. It's going to be a long path.
Help me, Sita, help me. It is. You know, but what I tell myself is that, you know, everything that we're experiencing, all the contrariness, you know, to life and to, you know, honoring nature and just basic human respect, all of that is being highlighted right now by a poor example. So, I mean, it's...
Exactly. And this, maybe this is the wake-up that we needed, is that now maybe people are yearning for more integrity, you know, for a more sense of honor and you know, real, truly caring for people, putting your own needs second, not first. And so I think that you're right. I think the contrast is making people say, hey, you know, is this what we've come to?
Yeah, you know, and a lot of it is because of our, you know, lethargic kind of response to life, you know, rather than, you know, and it takes highly charged emotions sometimes to get people to move, you know.
I think it does. I think you're right. I think, you know, it's very easy to fall back and be satisfied with the status quo, especially when you're just struggling to survive, you know, to take care of your basic needs.
Right.
And it takes a certain amount of energy to get wired up about the bigger issues.
Yeah.
You know, and I think with the climate situation and with the ecological situation, people have to experience it before it becomes a reality. You know, when you can't drink your water because it's so toxic, it becomes very real.
Yeah.
You know, when your farms are destroyed, it becomes real.
Exactly. And when you're constantly hearing from people who experience it, I never thought it would happen here. You know, And then for every person listening who never thinks it's going to happen where they are, you know, it causes them to sit back, I would think, and maybe think, you know, a little bit harder about things, a little bit more in depth.
You know, we last month when there were all these tornadoes going through the Midwest, and there was actually a tornado warning in New York, and I said to myself, "What? We don't have tornadoes here. You know, we have hurricanes, maybe, but we don't have tornadoes. I don't think it came, or maybe it just skirted us to the south, but." That's the kind of thing. It's like, you know, when the unexpected happens, then you begin to ask questions.
Right, right. Exactly. Well, Dina, this has really been a great chat. Thank you. I've learned a lot about Sita, and I'm sure
I'm so glad.
And, you know, and there's a lot to be learned from the story.
A lot to be learned. And I think his history has a lot to teach us looking at the foundational stories of other cultures also could be very important.
Yeah, I agree. So now, are you working on another book?
I am.
Next year?
Next year, 18 months maybe. Another reliving of, I'm not going to go into any details, but it's another looking back in history.
I'm just kind of picking on it since it was
Yeah. The stories keep coming.
I know. I can say once you start, you know, it's kind of hard to stop. I mean,
the channel's open.
Exactly. Well, thank you again for your time. I really
thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
Again, everyone. Bye-bye. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dina Merriam. We've been talking about her new book, The Untold Story of Sita, An Empowering Tale for Our Time. Again, you can find out more about, you can get the book from Amazon.com, but also you can find out more about Dina by visiting her website, for the in the Global Peace Initiative of Women at www.gpiw.org. Again, gpiw.org. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Remember, our show is available as a free podcast from Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. To follow our show, visit our homepage at byteradio.me and select the platform you use most. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at byteradio.me. Until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.